Good morning, happy Sunday, and welcome to On the Weekend Edition. I am your host, Brian Pettaway. Thank you so much for joining us on 1500 Radio this morning and every Sunday morning from 9 to 10. I'm going to be here with you. We're going to talk about many things. But remember, it is still Mental Health Awareness Month. So I want to get back to talking about our mental health because it's a very, very important topic. And like the Surgeon General says, there is a crisis in this country as it pertains to loneliness and isolation. And being very honest, there have been very few people in this country that have typically lived lonelier lives than those with intellectual and developmental disabilities. I mean, let's be real. As a society in this country and the rat race of life that we've made it, we have not always been as compassionate and understanding and helpful to those who are not functioning on the same social or intellectual level that we do. We have actually discarded and dismissed human beings in this society because they don't think at the same speed, they don't move at the same pace as what has been deemed normal. And when I say dismissed, I mean that. I mean, we have family members that we have locked in the basement or that we have put up in the attic. We've put them in sanitariums. I mean, anything, as long as us normal people didn't have to deal with them. Well, recently, and I mean recently, within the last month or so, I was introduced to a group of folks whose sole purpose as a company is to provide a safe environment while still empowering those persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities. By instead of isolating them, they make sure that these persons are fully accepted and included in their chosen communities. That means schools, neighborhoods, jobs, recreation and congregations, and it means that they have the opportunities to contribute their unique personalities and talents with others and live a full life in that community. The company is called Ardmore, A-R-D-M-O-R-E, and no, this is not a paid advertisement. I'm not getting paid to talk about this group today. I'm doing it because I had an opportunity to actually not only meet the staff, but to also meet some of the people with intellectual and developmental disabilities that they support. And I realized later on that without a company like Ardmore, a lot of the people that I met who are happy and who have pride in what they are doing would have been cast aside years ago. Oh, and by the way, Ardmore has been doing this and supporting IDD persons for 60 years now, six decades, since 1963, before I was born. So it's safe to say that they've helped hundreds, if not thousands of people live normal, happy, productive lives who, without Ardmore, may not have. And so now, because it is Sunday, the Church of Brian is going to take out the collection plate because Ardmore is a nonprofit that relies heavily on donations. And they have two fundraising events that are coming up. They have a 60-year anniversary celebration gala called A Journey Through Time, and that's happening June 22nd at the Country Club at Woodmore, which is in Bowie. And then in September, they're going to have the Ardmore's inaugural golf tournament, and that's September 21st. Now, I got to see if I can be a part of that, because nobody has more fun playing poorly on a golf course than I do, I'm sure. So I'm going to see if I can be a part of that. But listen, do what you can. If you can't attend the gala, which I hope that you can, be a part of the golf tournament. If you can't attend the golf tournament, if you don't play golf, be a part of the gala. Or just donate what you can. For more information, reach out to Robin Goldsmith. Just contact her. rgoldsmith@ardmoreenterprises.org. That's rgoldsmith@ardmoreenterprises.org. She'll have all the information that you need, and you can meet some of the staff that I've met, and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. And again, listen, I'm going to reiterate, this is not a paid ad. Like, I'm not getting paid to advertise the Ardmore company. I'm not doing that. This is Mental Health Awareness Month, and the people that I met who help people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are spectacular people, and they deserve recognition. And I have a little bit of a platform to give that recognition to help out, so I'm doing it. And I would appreciate if you would help them as well. When you help people, hey, the karma is unreal. All right, so moving on, I am going to get back to mental health awareness, that topic, but I want to do the news. I want to get petty in here. But I'm also going to rerun the very first show of the month with Dr. Baldwin, because she said some amazing things, and people asked me to rerun it. Now, I got to tell you, I'm going to rerun it today, but this will be the last show that I actually rerun like this, because now on my page, on my company page, voiceswired.com, that's voiceswired.com, you can go on to my page, and I have all of my shows archived. You just click on the show that you want to listen to, and there it is for you. That's voiceswired.com. Click the On Weekend Edition tab, and all of the shows will be lined up right there for you. Just click on it and you'll hear the show. Okay, before I rerun the interview with Dr. Baldwin, I want to get into some news. There have been some significant things happening in the world that are worth talking about. One of the things, sadly, is that Jim Brown, arguably the greatest football player to ever live, passed away on Thursday. A spokeswoman for Brown's family said that he passed away peacefully in his Los Angeles home on Thursday night with his wife Monique by his side. Along with Brown being an unstoppable runner and shattering rushing records for running backs at that time, he was also a prominent and fierce political and social advocate for civil rights for blacks. As black Americans fought for equality, Brown used his platform as a well-respected sports figure and an actor to advance our cause. Jim Brown, gone at 87 years old. May he rest in peace. All right, let's get to a little Baltimore news. WMAR is reporting that Baltimore City's first Lidl supermarket was closed on Friday by the health department. The city health department said that the North Baltimore store was closed due to a rat infestation. Now, mind you, the store was just opened last summer in the Northward Common Shopping Center, which had been revitalized, revamped, looked great. But apparently, the rats liked the new joint too, and they decided to stay. The company is also set to open a new store on Bel Air Road in Northeast Baltimore at the site of the former Byrite Market. A Lidl spokesperson said last month that a rumor that the store is not opening is not true. They said, "We look forward to opening another store in Baltimore in the future and serving the community with high-quality groceries and low prices. And hopefully, you know, no rats." Also on the local front, Governor Wes Moore signed Senate Bill 1 into law on Tuesday. The bill greatly limits where legal gun owners who have wear and carry permits can legally carry their guns. Immediately after that bill was signed into Maryland law, the NRA filed a lawsuit. But a severed man is protesting the law in a different way. A guy named Jaden McAdory has been walking the streets of his neighborhood armed with an AR-15. He says, "I'm not for banning any carry. I don't think people know that you can openly carry an AR-15. And he's been protesting deliberately near a school bus stop and in close proximity to schools. Now, this protest reached the governor's office, and he came out and said, "To stem the tide of gun violence and create safer, stronger communities, we need partnership, not shallow acts of cowardice and intimidation." The governor also said, "Scaring our kids and threatening our communities will not help make Maryland safe." Now look, I am a military vet and a former infantry soldier, and I trained on light artillery, M16, Berettas, M72, A2 Law, Sawgun. I trained on all of these things. I know the destruction that an AR-15 causes. It is not designed to kill deer. It is not designed just to protect your home. Like, what kind of life are you living where you need an AR-15 to protect your home? I don't understand that. That weapon is designed solely to kill as many people in a short amount of time as possible. That's all it's for. And when it's used, it's been primarily used in schools, it's been used at concerts, and it has not been used to protect a home. And if you're going to use the argument that you're protecting your home, why do you need it slung around your back at a Starbucks or a Walmart or in the parking lot? Like, why are you walking around the school premises with it? You know what's interesting is none of the guys that I served with, none of them, have an AR-15 because we know it's not a toy. It's not something to show our friends to be impressed about. We also understand that the minute somebody gets pissed off, they have a bad day, the world spins against them, or their child is bullied and they haven't secured that weapon properly, there's a potential that 50 people can die. You know, it's really that simple. That's how it's happened. The vast majority of the people that have been involved in these mass shootings purchased these weapons legally, or their parents purchased them legally and they got it from their parents. Why is an 18-year-old allowed to go purchase an AR-15? If you're 18 and you want to carry around an AR-15, go serve your country. Do that. It pisses me off. I mean, it really does, because it makes no sense. It makes zero sense. You can't have a drink at 18, right? But you can go and purchase a weapon of mass destruction. And I know I'm going to hear people say, "Yeah, Brian, but you can enlist in the military and you can go kill people when you're 18. And yes, you're right. You get no argument with me from that. However, before the government puts a weapon in your hand, the first thing they do is to teach you the respect for the power of that weapon. They train you how to use it. They train you how to store it. They train you how to clean it and they train you who the true enemy is. And that is the only time in which you are allowed to use that weapon. And when there was no battle and there was no training, that weapon stayed in the armory. I wasn't allowed to walk around posts with an M16 slung across my back. When guys who have served and who put their lives on the line in actual battle, who have trained in infantry units with weapons like these, and have signed their name on the dotted line saying, hey, I am trained, I'm ready to go if you need me, and I will die for this country. When we see these weekend warrior type people walking around in Walmart and Starbucks and, you know, in the parking lots with these AR-15s slung across their backs and these two weapons on their hips, we laugh at them. We think they're a bitch. Because what you want is attention. You're saying, look at me, look at my guns, look how scary and powerful I am. When in fact, what you are is a bitch. You were either that high school kid that got picked on a lot, and now you're able to have a gun and secure it and put it across your back and show people, hey, I'm big and strong now. Or you were the bully in high school that never stopped or grew out of being a bully. Either way, you're telling a lot about yourself. The least of which is that you're a man. So yeah, I know it's personal. I got a problem with it. But it's my show. And on my show, I'm going to have Wes Moore next month. I was able to secure another interview with him. And he's agreed to sit down and talk to me about a multitude of things. And one of the things I am going to bring up is this gun law that he just signed into law on Tuesday. All right. Out of Maryland, up in Rhode Island, a GOP Cranston City Council member, Matthew Riley, was arrested on drug possession charges after police found him sleeping in his vehicle with cocaine and fentanyl in his vehicle and a crack pipe in his hand. Riley was found and arrested by police Monday morning after a passerby tipped police off to a man who appeared to be having a medical episode in his car. The Republican Councilman Riley, 41, was found passed out in the driver's seat, and an officer on the scene told Riley, "You have a crack pipe in your hands." Riley, who was the chairman of the Cranston Republican Party, appeared disoriented but was polite and cooperated with police as he was questioned. He initially denied having drugs in his car, but later allegedly admitted to buying $100 worth of crack cocaine the day before. Police said that they discovered a white rock-like substance inside a container found in the vehicle's center console. The substance later tested positive for cocaine and fentanyl. Now, I watched the video footage from the vest cam of the arresting officer, and I was blown away. I want you to listen how they spoke to him. And remember, this is a guy that had been operating a vehicle on public roads under the influence and was found with crack cocaine in his hand and a pipe and cocaine and fentanyl in his vehicle. I want you to listen how they speak to him.
You've taken in some fentanyl, Matt, and that's we've got to make sure you may not feel it right now, but God forbid something happens to you. We feel terrible about that, you know?
That was the arresting officer. That was the guy that rolled up on him that found a crack pipe in his hand and fentanyl and cocaine in his vehicle that he had just been operating. Now, imagine if that were, I don't know, me. Right? Do you think... Listen, you know what I'm saying. You know what I'm saying. I promise you, I'm going to follow this case. I'm going to find out what his sentence was, if he's sentenced at all. And I'm going to let you know, because I have a sneaking suspicion that he is going to get off light as a feather. Okay, it's time to get back to our original topic today, which is mental health. And I am going to rerun the interview that I did with Dr. Carolyn Baldwin the very first week of this month, because a lot of people asked me to rerun it, and I promised them that I would. She said a lot of great things that, you know, we need to hear in reference to our mental health and the importance of it and how we can recognize problems in the mental health of those we love around us. So without further ado, here is that interview. Okay, 1500 listeners, please help me welcome Dr. Carolyn Yvette Baldwin. Dr. Baldwin, how are you this morning?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Doing well. I appreciate you so much for being with us this morning. I know you have a busy schedule, so I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Dr. Baldwin, you're actually a native of Chicago, is that correct?
That is correct. Born and raised in Chicago, Illinois. Came to Maryland to work. Worked in the school system in Chicago for about 8 years in the schools as a school psychologist. And then wanted to get a little bit more experience and wanted to get a little bit more exposure So I moved out to Maryland, and mostly because the school system was one of the top in the country. And so I wanted to get the experience of going from a complete urban area to a more diverse population.
Okay. Did you find that here?
I did. When I shifted from Chicago Public Schools, I actually went from working with students in a general education population to more students with severe profound disabilities. So I have a background in neuropsychology, and I started working with students that were identified as severe profound on the autism spectrum and severe chromosome disorders and syndromes and things like that. So I got to work with a very specific kind of population and really trying to help educators to understand their learning style, their learning patterns, right, and ways to help them to actually learn within the environment.
I always ask my guests, like, what inspired or motivated them to get into the field they're in? What was your inspiration? What motivated you to become a psychologist?
So I have and have always felt that I have had a compassionate heart. I think I am a servant leader, and I always have been. But as growing up in high school, I had a very dear friend of mine whose brother was identified with a disability. At the time, I didn't really understand what his disability was, didn't really know what it was. I just knew he was different from what we were learning like.
Right.
And I found it to be just very interesting to be able to help him in different ways and needing to think outside the box when we were around him to really kind of help him to understand and be integrated into the things that we were doing. And so that was probably my first introduction. And then I have a cousin who has cerebral palsy. And again, just trying to help people understand what her learning style was and her learning pattern was.
Mm-hmm. Now, honestly, back in the day, like back in the early 70s, I remember a lot of times when Black families had the quote-unquote special person in the family, you rarely mm-hmm. saw them out and about. We kind of hid them as opposed to trying to understand them. We dealt with them in-house.
Right.
Now, there's been, thankfully, a huge transition from that treatment to trying to understand the neurological disorders that lie within some people. Have you found that to be true, in particular in the Black community?
I have found that to be true. We are a little bit more aware of disabilities. We're a little bit more compassionate, and we're definitely more knowledgeable about them.
Awesome. You've got quite the resume. You got quite the educational resume. Let me see. You have a Bachelor of Science in Finance, a Master's of Education in School Psychology, a PhD in Counseling and Educational Psychology, and a minor in Neurological Psychology. You even have a Master's of Divinity in Pastoral Care.
I do. It sounds like a lot.
It is a lot.
It is, but the theme of all of my training is I'm an analyst. So I'm an analyst of any type of behavior. So with the finance degree, it's an analyst of finances. In the psychology area, is an analyst of behaviors. And in theology, it's an analyst of different kinds of behaviors and spirits. So
now, do they all mesh for you at some point? Like, do you use all of these, this educational background?
Yes. Okay. Yes. And pastoral care is really looking at, if you will, the psychology when you being able to apply those psychological principles within the theological framework.
Okay. So really quick, explain to my listeners the difference of a psychologist and a psychiatrist.
Very simple difference. We both have the training in the science areas, but a psychiatrist prescribes medication. A psychologist usually does not.
Okay.
A psychiatrist usually has a medical degree as well.
A psychiatrist does.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've been in the school system between, I guess, Chicago and Maryland for like, 20 plus years or so?
Little more than 20 years, yes.
Okay. And you said you were in the urban areas of Chicago dealing with kids.
Yes.
Did you find their stresses different from what you find here in Maryland and Montgomery County?
So here's the thing.
Okay.
Children are children, no matter where you have them. It is the exposure, the society, and the environment that they are around that tend to shape them. So what I found to be different really has to do with the environmental factors.
Okay. And that's what I meant. I mean, they call Chicago Chirac, all kinds of stuff, with all the violence. Now, there's a lot of violence in Baltimore, but with all of the violence and the attention to it in Chicago in particular, did you find that those kids were I guess, more stressed or more highly stressed than those in Montgomery County that you see?
No.
No. Okay.
No. And the reason that I say, that is because I'm going to go back to environmental factors. So, violence and trauma and mental health concerns, substance abuse, academic pressure, they're everywhere. The environmental factors always make the difference. You mentioned Chicago being referred to as Chirac. That is probably a more recent title or name or categorization that Chicago has gotten over, I would say, the last 10 years or so. I've been out of Chicago for quite some time.
Okay.
But
okay.
I can tell you that my dissertation looked at the effects of violence and post-traumatic stress on kids' ability to achieve. So I did look at that. At the time, I was looking at, and it's still prevalent now, at really the breakdown in the shootings within schools and how kids kind of bounce back from violent and traumatic kind of events.
So what, they're more mental and emotional resilient than they used to be? I mean,
they are. That's hard to say, because resiliency is something that I'm really looking at a lot now with students. I would say that the issues have not really shifted too much. And I don't think it's just a Chicago, Maryland thing, because I think about school shootings that happen or violence that happens in schools like all across the nation, even within the college campuses now. Those kinds of resiliency patterns are things that I'm currently studying and currently looking at.
Okay, so the studying for you never stops, so to speak.
No, it doesn't stop. No, it never stops.
So your approach to children, do you counsel adults at all?
I do. I mostly deal with students, though. I deal with children, and mostly because of the developmental factors. It's not that adults don't have those same kinds of things. It's just my area of expertise is really looking at those developmental places and those places of impact and impasse that happen within the developmental years. So even if I'm talking to adults and I'm helping to consult with them and trying to move them past an impasse, I usually try to go back to, where did this all start?
Okay. I'm glad I'm talking to you, someone who was doing this in the school system, because I know how kids have it, and it's, you know, and I know they can be stressed and they need counseling,
mm-hmm.
but teachers are going through it. I mean, they're going through the ringers. Who is taking care of them?
That is a really good question. And I can tell you within our district, we definitely try to assist the teachers. Like, I don't limit myself to the students. I never turn anyone around if they come in into my office and needing to kind of talk or decompress or, you know, just try to move past a situation. But that is a really good question. And I think those are things that systems are starting to really look at, particularly after the pandemic. I think there pre-pandemic, there were some things that were going on that, you know, they could look at EAP and they could look employee assistance programs and they could look at different wellness type platforms and social emotional training that they could do, and they could probably reach a good percentage of teachers and the adults that were working. But after the pandemic, that whole idea of societal loneliness kicked in, which is the understanding that there's this collective loneliness and disconnection and isolation mm-hmm. that happens.
Right.
A lot of that started really raising its head after the pandemic because everybody was isolated.
Yeah, I have a friend that just, well, didn't just, but 3 years ago, quit teaching position because she said she felt like she was suffering from PTSD, and she started getting yeah. counseling for that particular symptom.
Yeah.
And she said if she had had a therapist or psychologist on staff at the school that she could speak to kind of regularly, then maybe it would not have manifested itself into the problem that it became. But the union didn't have anyone that they would refer her to, and they weren't willing to pay for it. Like, she had to pay for it out of her pocket.
That's so you touched on several things. Okay. So there should be a school psychologist in almost every school. We are, like, I wish I could say that I'm unique to this field, but I'm not. We have an entire national organization, and every school district has school psychologists. So we are definitely present. We are definitely there. So we are involved. The challenge with our profession, however, is that there are not enough of us.
Okay.
And so that's when, and that goes for even with working with the students. When you start talking about teachers leaving the profession, particularly post-pandemic, it's not just the mental health. I'm going to go back to that social isolation, societal loneliness piece. That social isolation impacted households as well as school systems, as well as the students, as well as the adults.
Right.
Nobody was safe during that. So in coming back into a school system, even if some districts came in earlier than others, when you come back in, you have to factor in the fact that everybody has been impacted. Some districts were very good at that, and some districts maybe not so much. It's hard for me to judge that, but you had to look at the totality of your staff members. And a lot of districts did put a lot of social-emotional programs in place and put wellness programs and wellness centers within schools. A lot of things were added post-pandemic that are still being implemented.
Okay. Well, that's good to know.
I just want to say, not just for students, but also for staff.
For staff. Okay. Yeah, I feel bad for teachers. I mean, I really do. Because, you know, they go through it. First of all, they're underpaid and overworked. The responsibilities they're given with no autonomy is beyond the pale. And I just think they're very unappreciated and often the ones that are in the trenches that are often left behind, to be honest with you, mentally and psychologically. You did mention something that I wanted to, because this, as you know, it's what, Mental Health Awareness Month, right?
Yes.
And that's one of the biggest reasons I wanted to have you on today, is because it's one thing to hear people talk about it on the outside, but not to know exactly what that means and how important it is. You know, it was important to me that my listeners know, which is why I have you here today. But the U.S. Surgeon General mentioned last week, was it Vivek Murthy? I think that's his name, Dr. Vivek Murthy, was talking about loneliness being an epidemic in this country. And he read off some statistics, which I was shocked about, and I don't necessarily completely understand, but he said that loneliness causes a 29% increase in heart disease, a 32% increase in stroke, a 50% increase in dementia amongst older people, and a 60% increase or chance of a premature death. That's crazy to me. Like loneliness?
Yes.
Break that down for me, please.
Okay. So what happens, what you're really talking about is, when we think of loneliness, we think, oh, I miss this one person.
Exactly.
But it's bigger than that when you start talking about these kinds of statistics. And I'm going to go back to pandemic time and social isolation. So the definition of societal loneliness is the feeling of being disconnected, isolated, or alienated due to the lack of a meaningful social connection. So think of people who were in their places alone, or in their places with abusers, or in their places, you know, in these isolated, stuck places that they literally could not get out of. And there was all these things that were going on in the world. And when you start talking about physical health and chronic illness or chronic loneliness, it's associated with those types of diseases, because you don't move. You don't get up. You don't move around. You're not exercising. That's why it was such a big push. That's why Peloton was so big during the pandemic, because it offered people the idea that they could get a workout and a vigorous type of workout and get their bodies moving from the places of which they were. So that physical health becomes that much more important when you start talking about loneliness and isolation and disconnectedness. Mental health is so much bigger than I am just depressed or I am anxious. Your mind starts to going. So now you have these thoughts that are just kind of playing in your head, and you go through a lot of what ifs. And if you have no one there to talk to and bounce those ideas and those thoughts off of, it literally just goes into a big circle.
Right.
You have that reduced social connectedness. And then people particularly, and I keep going back to the pandemic because it was so critical, people were dying. People were losing people. And sometimes people were losing people right in the midst of them, and they felt helpless. So those types of things would definitely start colliding together.
Right.
And start making their own narrative for you.
Wow.
It also, and that social isolation also has an increased risk for addictions to begin too.
Okay. What's interesting to me is, as bad as that sounds, he also said that the effects of social isolation is the equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
and I thought to myself, how does one measure that? But I guess it's all about, like you said, heart disease, movement, taking care of yourself during that time.
Yeah, we assume, so I'm a very active person. I know this is radio, but I'm a very active person. And it's one way, it's one thing to assume that everyone is at least half as active as you are.
Right.
But if you really think about it, the majority, the reason that gym memberships go up in January and, you know, depending on where people live in the United States or whatever country they live in, activity, physical activity is not always something that people engage in.
Right. No, you have to make time for it.
Right. And you assume that people actually know how to actually engage in some level of physical activity. And it's so much easier to eat comfort foods and to eat foods and to engage in activities that are soothing and comforting, which is why that addiction piece becomes that much bigger. And when I say addiction, I don't necessarily just mean drugs, alcohol. I mean social media. I mean, you have to find an outlet in it. And sometimes it's healthy and sometimes it's not.
Well, what do you think, what kind of role do you think social media plays in the whole isolation area? Do you think it's made it worse for people? Because we seem to, you know, you have things that can completely make you a recluse. You have Amazon. They'll deliver anything to your house. You got HubGrub and all of this stuff. You've got, you never really have to leave your house anymore.
Right.
And people, I guess, are not. We don't know how to talk to each other anymore. Everything is through text. The art of conversation has left us. Like, how is social media playing a role for us? Is it a detriment to us as much as an asset?
So my personal take on, and my professional take on social media is the six in one hand, half a dozen in the other.
Okay.
It's an integral component of who we are now. Again, we spend almost 2 years in front of our computers on a device. And that's how we were able to get our jobs done. That's how we were, as you mentioned, that's how we were able to get our groceries delivered. That's how we were able to get food. Like, all kinds of great things happen with social media. It's like anything else, though. You have to be able to modulate it, and you have to be able to mediate it and be able to balance it out to know, am I getting too far in? Am I getting too far over to the left? Should I come away from it? How much social interaction do I need to do here? You know, is there someone else I can talk to? Is there, for some people, social media became, those were the only voices that they got to hear during a period of time.
Right, right.
And that was their connection to the outside. And that doesn't make it bad, but that does then decrease their social skills when they have to go and engage with a live person.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of the things that we used to be able to do as people in social gatherings, they cause anxiety now because of, like, mass shootings, right?
Yes.
You know,
yes.
You don't want to go to a concert as much as you used to, or a ball game, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. a cookout, because you never know what's going to break off. You know what I mean? And that's caused a lot of anxiety. And anxiety and depression, and I think bipolar disorder, are the three things that are the leading causes of mental disorders in this country right now. Is that right?
Yes.
Sort of.
I'll go with you on that. I'm going to go with you on that for a little bit. because some are neurological and so not so much caused by one or the other. Some have some different origins to them. But yes, the depression, the anxiety, I'm following. Yes.
Okay. So does one manifest itself into the other? Like, what comes first, the chicken or the egg?
So that's hard to tell, right? And that's why I kind of was like, I don't know. I think that it's not really just a social media issue. It's not just a pandemic issue. You bring up a very interesting point about the being afraid to go into society and engage society as we knew it at one point. I think what happened with social media and the period that we were in that forced us to see online is that we were literally stopped in our tracks to actually observe and be aware of what was happening. I don't think any of those things weren't happening before, but we were constantly moving. We were always in and out, and some things you saw, some things you didn't see, some things you were right, you know, right there for, some things you weren't, some things you got at 6 o'clock that maybe happened at 2 o'clock. And I think what happened during a certain period is that we were forced to be still.
Okay.
And so all we were doing was watching that. Like, we were just literally locked in. And so everything that happened, you were so much more heightened. You're so much more aware of it. And now you have a different feeling about it. You have a different awareness of it. You have a different knowledge base for it. So I don't think it wasn't happening before. I just think that the awareness became different. And when you talk about mental illness and those different kinds of behaviors and categories of mental illness, anxiety and depression, I do think heightened, right? You know, in the last 3 to 5 years, particularly, they heighten. And coming out of the pandemic, yes, we are definitely much more aware and much more cautious about our environments than we were prior to.
So do you think it's something that'll work its way out? I mean, you know what I mean, over time?
I think there are coping strategies. I didn't mean to cut you off. I think there are coping strategies that need to happen. I think that there are definitely trainings and resiliency. Like, I talk a lot about resiliency. Those kinds of trainings definitely become that much more of a focal point. I think what we're learning how to do is understand what our bounce back is. And I don't think that was something, it's just like any other behavior. I don't think we had to focus on our bounce back before because we didn't have anything that we needed to really bounce
right.
back from.
Right.
Unless you had your own individual tragedy or your own, you know,
right.
individual situation that you had to come back from. We didn't have as a whole global community a need to learn a bounce back, but resiliency is the ability to adapt from an adverse situation. And I think that becomes this really big piece for us as a people to be able to understand what's your mindset going to be, because what you tell yourself is how you're going to react.
Right.
So if you keep telling yourself all this negative, that's how you're going to respond. If you start bringing in that growth mindset and being able to understand how challenges can become stepping stones and those kinds of things, that's how you respond to it.
So do you think that exercise, physical exercise, is a way to ward off some of the problems that we have with
Absolutely.
Our emotional? Okay.
Absolutely. Physical exercise, and one of the reasons, the biggest reason, is that it gets all of your it gets your neurons moving. It gets your whole neurological system and it gets your whole system to moving around. And so you move that energy around. Self-care practices, exercise, mindfulness practices, sleep is huge. So many people don't sleep. People don't sleep. And so many people have trouble sleeping. Trying to find a good sleep routine is huge. Being able to eat the right things, what we feed ourselves, how we handle our bodies is critical.
I get beat up about the lack of sleep that I get okay. on a daily basis.
Okay.
Like, I don't sleep. My sleep patterns are not good. Sometimes I work until 3 a.m. and I sleep for about 3 hours to get up and back at it again. But I've always been told two things. A, successful people rarely have time for sleep. And B, there's always time to sleep when you're dead. So,
okay, those are very interesting.
So okay. I don't, you know, I mean, I kind of grind, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So my own personal thought on the sleep is that I don't know if you necessarily need 8 hours. I know, you know, there have been all kinds of studies. One study says 8 hours, one says you only need 6. I don't know if the time of sleep is as important as the quality of your sleep.
Thank
you. If you get 3 good hours
right.
of sleep and you wake up and you feel like, okay, I can move to the next space and I can do it with ease, I think you've done yourself a good service. And the reason that I say that is because when you sleep, what you're doing is you're shutting off your brain. So if you can get three, four good hours where your brain is not doing anything and you're resetting, then you've done a good service. Here's how I liken it. If your computer starts to go haywire, your cell phone starts to just kind of, you know, none of your apps are opening and all kinds of things, what's the very first thing you do?
You shut it off. Yeah.
You shut it off for a period of time. You let it reboot and then you turn it back on and voila, it is back in service.
Right.
And it's the same thing. Your system, you have a rhythm, you have a flow. And when your system and your rhythm and your flow is off, you have to reset it. That's where that self-care piece comes in.
Right.
That's where you know when your eating is off. You know, some people's skin breaks out. Some people get upset stomach. What do? You stop, you reset, and you eat differently.
Right. Well, I got 2 more things, and I'll let you roll. One of them is, as a black man, right, mm-hmm. I know the feeling of telling someone that you're going to get therapy, you're going to talk to a therapist or get medication. It's a feeling of weakness, shame or embarrassment. And that feeling has quietly kept a lot of men like myself in peril, emotional peril, right?
Okay.
We just don't reach out to get it for that reason. Now, I started seeing a therapist finally, and it's opened up all kinds of doors. I mean, I feel great, but I wanted to know what it is about that stigma. Like, where did it come from? Why is it there, and how we can get past it as a community of black men?
I think that it's long term. I don't think it just started 10 years ago, 5 years ago. I think there's always been a stigma, particularly in the black community, not just with black men, but in the black community about going to see a therapist. You know, in the black community particularly, I can speak to that just because I grew up in it. And I remember being in grad school, we would rather go sit in our grandmother's kitchen or with our aunts or with our uncles or whoever, where our safe space is, and hash out our problems than to go to someone we don't really know or think we don't trust to tell them our problems. That's one thing. But I think that has shifted, and those myths have been shattered along the way, because I think we realize that we need more. And that we need to allow ourselves to trust a little bit more. I think we're more knowledgeable and we're more aware of therapy. I always say, though, that people are not excited to go see their therapist.
Nobody, true.
Nobody says, I'm going to see my therapist today. I can't wait to go. Nobody does that.
Not if you're doing the work.
Instead, people say, ooh, I got to go see my therapist.
Right,
today.
Right.
Because they know that they're going to break down a door and they know they're going to have to bring that effort. But that's actually a good thing, because after they see their therapist, they come out like, you know what, I want to see my therapist today. And I think you should go see a therapist because of these reasons. So it's not the same kind of happy, joyous place that you go, but it's the necessary place that you go.
Absolutely.
It's like any other kind of doctor. But even with black men, I think about black men in therapy. There's a black therapist, male therapist, and he's all around social media, Jay Barnett. I love him. I love his transparency. And I think he and the group and the organizations that he works with does a lot to help to break the stereotype of black men going to therapists and being able to be vulnerable enough and still hold on to their manhood and still being able to hold on to their masculinity to go and address those things that have been weighing them down.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely masculinity loss attached to admitting that you've seen a therapist or that you're seeing one. I mean, you feel it when you say it, depending on who you're saying it to.
I don't know if it gets lost or if it's something that was implanted. It's almost like an implanted seed that says, if you go see a therapist, you lose something. When the reality is, if you go see a therapist, you might gain something. you might gain a part of you that you thought you had lost. You might gain a part of you that you had hidden for a while. You might gain a part of you that needed to grow. I don't think it's a negative, not just because I sit on that side of the table, but because I just understand the value that's in it. And I think, like I said, it's a seed that has to be plucked up and say, no, that's not really the narrative that we want to walk with. I'm back to what we say to ourselves and how we talk to ourselves.
I know that you are not an expert in the drug field. You're not a psychiatrist. But how do you feel about antidepressants as opposed to maybe holistic approaches?
So I don't... I think that they're good for what they're good for. I don't have a bias one way or the other to them. I always say to when I work with families, for example, and I'm working with a student that might be that might have a medication prescription, I always say what the medication does is it's not a cure-all. The medication helps you to gain access to those cognitive functions that you need to move through whatever that impasse is.
Okay.
So it's a means to an end. And another example that I give is I have asthma. I could choose not to take my asthma medicine and still function around here. The problem is going to be I'm not going to be breathing as well.
Okay.
So right. I take the medication, not because my asthma goes away, but I take the medication so that I can breathe properly, so that I can get through the day without having that limp or that struggle or that impasse to kind of keep following me every step of the way. So I think medication has its place. I don't have a problem with it one way or the other. I think that you also need more than that sometimes, though. I think sometimes we think that if we take the medicine that it's a magic pill and it's going to cure that. It probably will get you closer to you being available to get now the strategies and to use the coping skills and the treatment plans that are being offered to you.
How can we recognize as parents or friends or loved ones signals or symptoms in people that we care about that they might need some help? And how do we recognize it in ourselves?
I think in others, you have to be aware of who they are. I think if you're looking at something like a mental health concern, you're noticing any shifts in patterns of behavior. If you know that someone is generally just a very happy, outgoing person, and now all of a sudden they've kind of pulled to the back and they are more isolated and don't really, you know, are not as social and not as engaging, that would be one thing to kind of look and say, hey, is something going on? You know, do you need to talk? And that's always a good end. Like, do you need to talk? Also, if you know, I want to kind of back to something that you talked about with Black men and stereotypes.
Okay.
If someone is very strong, I always say check on your strong friends.
Okay.
If someone is very strong and they say to you, hey, I don't think I'm okay, hear them.
Okay.
Don't say, because you know them, oh, you're okay. Don't
you
worry
got
about
this.
It. No. Just say, okay, I hear you. Like, I heard you. Let's talk. Let's talk through it and then get a little bit more information, a little bit more awareness. I think awareness becomes the big key factor here.
Right.
And you just being able to know people and being able to see changes in behaviors and activities. Within oneself, again, I'm going to go with awareness, knowing yourself, knowing when something feels off in you. If you had a cold or you just started feeling some kind of ache and pain in your body, the very first thing that you would do is you would say, I don't know, my leg is seeming like it's not okay. I think I'm going to call my doctor, right?
Right.
But
right.
If you have some kind of shift in your thought process, or you know some big events have kind of shifted your mindset and changed your mood, you might want to say, you know what, I may need to just go and talk to someone. And just like if you go talk to any doctor and you get there and they say, we didn't find anything, at least you went. And there is some record that, you know what I mean, that you
right.
at least tried to address it. And now you feel better. Now you can figure out, what do I need to do next?
You know, what's weird about that is I was in the military, and I've lost a lot of my friends to suicide in the last 3 or 4 mm-hmm. years, right? And so we have a group where we check in. We do exactly that, you know, on Facebook where we check in. But what I have found is there have been times where I wasn't suicidal at all, but I certainly wasn't okay, where I felt like, but because everybody else is saying they're okay, you don't want to say that you're not feeling okay. You know what I mean? It's like reverse peer pressure. So how do we combat that? Like how, because I think at the end of the day, the most honest person you have to be with is, or be to, is yourself. And I don't think we are most of the time.
I would say in that situation that you find a trusted, that you find your trusted safe space. So you may have to just find that safe person and say, you know, I really am not okay. I'm like, something is off. And I think if you say it to a trusted person that knows you, so I'm back to awareness, they know you, then they will be the ones to say, okay, let's just talk through it then. You know, it may, like you said, you're not suicidal. You're not feeling like you want to harm yourself.
Right.
But you may feel like you need to talk. And I think a lot of times we feel like we're bothering people.
Exactly.
And we're invading on people.
Right.
But the reality is that if you are considered a good friend, those are the people that you want to be able to talk to. Those are the people that you want to hear you. And those are the people that you want to be heard with, because it goes back to this understanding of, I heard this definition of intimacy. Dr. Renita Weems, she's a theologian. She's this was years ago. She wrote this book called I Asked for Intimacy. And when she was doing, this was literally in the 80s, when she did this tour on this book, her definition of intimacy was the knowing and being known by someone naked, and it's okay. And she said the naked is not physical nakedness, but it's in their vulnerability, and it's okay. And that's really what true friendship is. Because if you think about your true friends, they know your goods, your bads. they know all those little places, and you know, it's all good. It's like,
right.
Okay, I still love you. let's go get some ice cream now. We're good.
But you know? You said the V word. And vulnerability and masculinity often live on complete opposite sides of the street.
They do. And I think that, but that becomes where you have to become aware of who you are and understanding that vulnerability does not make you weak.
Okay.
Vulnerability a lot of times makes you that much stronger. Now, it's a difference between being vulnerable and just relinquishing who you are.
Right.
Being vulnerable is really just your being able to be, this is who I am, like being transparent about those places. And again, it's never what you do, it's always how you do it. But if you're just kind of giving off this all the time, that's a different issue. It's something different. But vulnerability is not a bad thing.
Okay.
And you don't have to lose yourself in vulnerability. You just have to be able to say, okay, I just want to let you know this is a real place for me.
Right. Well, listen, the time has escaped us. I'm so, so appreciative of you being here. And you are now officially a member of the 1500 Radio family. And
well, thank you so much.
Well, you say that, but I'm going to be calling you on you again. So be ready.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
All right, Dr. Bolvin, you take care of yourself now, okay?
Thank you. And thank you to your audience. Have a very good afternoon, and I will talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Be careful and have self-care.
Absolutely. Till next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, I know you hear the music. That can only mean one thing, and that is the Petty. Now, what you just heard as far as the interview goes is absolutely a rerun from the first week of this month with Dr. Baldwin. But what I'm about to talk about with the Petty right now is live and new. So let's get him on the phone. Let's see what he's talking about this week.
Good morning, Brother B. How are you?
I'm good, Petty. How you doing this morning?
I'm doing just great.
Awesome. What you got for me?
Well, SFL is over, and there was a huge mistake made on my part, so I'd like to clear it up.
Okay.
There was an upset almost equivalent to when the Giants upset the Patriots, but not as big. We're talking the XFL. Now I'm talking about those 4-6 Renegades, who I don't even know how they made it to the playoffs, upset the DC Defenders.
No.
So my era, the Renegades were home in Texas because They are actually from Arlington, Texas, and DC went down there and they dropped the ball, so to speak.
I don't understand that, man. Good Lord.
The XFL champs are the Renegades and not the Defenders. So sorry for that blunder on my part. Now, also in the XFL, there have been more invitees to the camps. There have been several signings to the NFL. And some of those guys, you know, they're getting their second chance. Hopefully, they'll stay there. Moving on to the USFL. The best team in the USFL, the New Orleans Breakers, who were undefeated, were upset by the Memphis Showboats. We're now on a two-game winning streak. They were 0-3. They won their first game, and then they went up against the unbeaten Breakers, and they upset the Breakers. Okay. So other teams are kind of like knocking each other off, and New Orleans was just like rising to the top, and then they ran across those Showboats. And so now there are no more undefeated teams in the USFL.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a fluke, though. I don't think the Showboats are. I just don't think that's going to happen for them.
Yeah, well, they upset the Breakers. Let's see where it goes from there.
All right.
And I'm a sports guy. Football is really my thing. I'm a sports guy. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the NBA. And Doc Rivers fired in Philly after the Sixers had that big loss up in Boston. I mean, they just look horrible. I mean, you know, everybody's talking about Embiid is soft, Harden, but Harden is Harden. And they're saying Doc couldn't get it done. He was only there for three seasons, you know? So how long does it take for a coach? I mean, it's like everybody is on that win-now mentality.
Yeah, I know.
Like, we got to win now.
Doc's an excellent coach. An excellent coach. And look how far he took them into the playoffs. Like, it's, you know, to me, it's ridiculous.
Well, the knock on Doc is that they can't get out of the second round. So, you know, the people of Philly are saying good riddance. They're glad Doc Rivers are gone. But who are they going to get to replace him? Who's going to put up with that big baby type of mentality from Embiid, who's pointing the fingers at everyone else but not taking accountability for himself? You know, he did not show up. He's the league MVP, and he played like a chump. But, you know, like I said, Harden's Harden. And there's rumor floating around that Harden may be returning back to Houston. There's also rumor that Harden was the one responsible for Doc getting fired.
Really?
And now he's about to abandon ship with the Sixers. Like I said, these are only rumors, so we shall see.
Okay.
The Lakers and the Nuggets are doing their thing out in the West, and LeBron and crew cannot get it done right now because they are down in the series, and they may be ousted. Now, some people saying that Jokic is the real MVP because he's getting it done for Denver.
Right.
Because they are just kicking Ellie's butt all over the place.
But he has a better supporting cast than Embiid does.
True as that may be, but he is showing up to play. He's putting up the numbers. Something
yeah,
that Embiid didn't do.
Yeah, you're right.
And here in the East, the Heat. Man,
Butler killing us.
Oh, they can handle, and I think we're looking at a Denver Nugget Miami Heat finals.
Yeah, Jimmy Butler's killing it.
Yes, he is. Don't get in his face. They found that out Friday evening when someone called him out, and Jimmy said, "Okay, just wait till the fourth quarter. You think you got Tatum? You know what? I can light up just as well." And he started lighting up in the fourth quarter, and I'm telling you, those Heat is on fire.
Yeah.
And Brother B, if you haven't been paying attention, you gotta talk about your high flying O's. I mean, they are still getting it done. They're staying hot. They got the second best record they're tied for the second best record in the majors, along with the Dodgers, and the Dodgers in the National League. So, you know, they have the second best record in baseball.
I just don't want to jinx them. You know what I mean?
And I'm not jinxing. I'm telling you, Brother B. Listen, remember we talked about who are those guys?
Right.
Let's talk about a name that everybody should be talking about in Baltimore. He's that little fire plug. He's the one that's getting started. I'm talking about Cedric Mullins, the seventh player in Oreo history to hit for the cycle.
When did he hit for the cycle?
He hit for the cycle, Cedric Mullins. A single, a double, a triple, and a homer all in one game.
Yeah, I missed that.
Only the seventh player in Oreo history to do it.
Wow.
And he did it in Camden Yards.
Okay.
So there's another name for you. Cedric Mullins. Ceddie. now. Here's a tidbit for you, Brother B, that I'm going to drop this right here, right now. You know, I get some hot stuff every now and then.
Right.
There's a possibility there may be some expansion in the major leagues. There might be two more teams added.
Really?
And with that being said, there may be realignment.
Okay.
Just like they did in the NFL. So you better watch out for that.
Okay.
And if it happens, you know where you heard it first. Possible expansion, possible realignment.
Now, does it have anything to do with the A's going to Las Vegas?
I'm not going to say. Okay. I'm going to be hush-hush mums on that one.
Okay. All right.
And like I said, because I'm a sports guy, I'm going to cover that other sport. And I'm talking about hockey. You know, I like hockey. I grew up watching hockey. I love it. I like going, you know, just checking out some games. And you know what? All the sports GMs, I'm talking about baseball, basketball, football, and either GMs in hockey should take a look from this team who's emerged as my favorite hockey team. And I'm talking about those Golden Knights out of Vegas.
Okay. All right. You got to think for Vegas sports teams, man.
Well, you know, because Vegas is starting to emerge as a sports city.
Okay.
But here's something about that team. This is their fifth year in existence, okay? They have made the playoffs 4 of the 5 years that they've been in existence. In their very first year, their inaugural year, as a team, they went to the Stanley Cup Finals.
Right. I remember that.
So their GM is doing something right out there in Vegas, and other GMs need to take note.
Right.
He's
right.
Put a team together with a mix of youth and veterans, and they're getting it done out in Vegas. And they might be going to another Stanley Cup Finals this year. So even if you're not a hockey fan, just check out what they're doing as a sports organization, because they're doing something right out there in Vegas.
Okay. All right.
And finally, Brother B, I have some sad news to report. We lost 2 giants in the sports world this month. I'm talking about the 3-time champ, Cy Young and MVP award winner. I'm talking about Vida Blue.
That's right. I remember Vida Blue from the neighborhood, actually.
And we got a chance to meet Vida Blue when he visited our neighborhood. Him and John Blue Moon Odom. And to hear his passing, it was a sad day because I remember Vida Blue. I remember every time the A's came to play the Orioles and watching Vida Blue just take them down.
Yes.
And here's a big one. This guy, and we're talking about, Vida Blue was a Hall of Famer, but this guy was a Hall of Famer. He's a legend. And in my book, he is the greatest running back of all time. I'm talking about the legendary Jim Brown, who passed away on Thursday.
No. Horrible, bro. We're down about that.
And it's just, man, you're talking about two sports legends, giants, and, man, my heart is just broken. We're talking about Vida Blue, Jim Brown. May they both rest in peace.
Absolutely. Now, Jim Brown was a little bit before me as far as a football player. Now, I've seen footage of him, obviously, but I remember him on the silver screen mostly. I remember him as, you know, Slaughter, Three the Hard Way with Fred Williamson, Jim Kelly, you know, that kind of thing. He was just a beast on the screen, but I know he was a hell of a football player and a hell of a lacrosse player too.
Yes, he was, Brother B, and some say he was a better lacrosse player than he was a football player.
Yeah.
Can you imagine
that? He was a basketball
that?
Player. He played basketball for Syracuse too.
Yeah. Exactly. There's a little backstory behind Jim Brown and how he went to the Cleveland Browns, but that's for another time. Like I said, I'm sorry to hear both their passings, and it lets me know that I'm getting older because I watched those guys pass away. I watched these legends get older, and they're gone. And, man, these were two great athletes in their sports, and they'll be sadly missed.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt.
Well, on that note, Brother B, I got to get out of here. I wish I had some really happy news to end on, but I had to mention those two.
Hey, man,
you know,
I'm with you.
Just huge.
I'm with you. I appreciate you as always, brother.
I got to go, Brother B. Enjoy. I love the show. As always, keep on doing what you're doing. Peace.
All right, brother. Take care.
Well, there you have it. There's the Petty. Always glad to have the Petty on every single week with me. He just makes me feel like he knows what he's talking about. You know what I mean?
So, you know, I got to be honest with you. I love hearing about the O's. I love hearing about the Ravens and all the other things that the Petty talks about. But this whole thing with Jim Brown dying, it's kind of got me down a little bit. You know, it seems like all of my icons from childhood are passing away. You had Harry Belafonte recently. Now you got Jim Brown. And here's the thing about Jim Brown. Like, I missed him as a football player. He was before my time as a football player. Though as a football player, I've seen lots of film footage of him, and he was an amazing running back. But I loved him as an actor as a kid because, you know, he was that strong black cat that everybody wanted to be like. Movies like Three the Hard Way, Slaughter, you know, I mean, they were blaxploitation movies, low-budget movies, but, you know, him, Fred Williamson, and Jim Kelly, those were the three smoothest cats in the black culture that everybody wanted to kind of be like, you know what I mean? So him leaving us and being gone, you know, it's a little sad today. However, the silver lining is that he lived his life the way he wanted to live it. He retired from football at age 29 at the peak, at the height of his career, because he just decided he didn't want to do it anymore. He decided to get into acting, and he crushed the acting game, loved it, did well in it, prospered because of it, made lots of money. He was an activist for and championed black rights, and he, when I say championed it, he killed it. He did everything he possibly could until the day he died for black folks. So though selfishly, like a lot of people, I'm sad that he's gone. I'm so happy and I'm so proud of how Jim Brown lived his life and the legacy that he left behind. All right, like every week, I'm going to remind you to hit me up and give me some feedback on IG at On with Brian Pettaway. And let me know how you feel about the gun laws in this country. Are they too strict? Are they too lax? What would you do? What is your advice to government to help keep these mass shootings from happening as often as they're happening? All right. Again, at On with Brian Pettaway on IG. I look forward to your feedback. It always helps me. But right now, I want you to do nothing. I want you to enjoy your Sunday, relax, chill out, do nothing. But tomorrow, I want you to wake up and conquer the world. I want you to put your best foot forward, have all the energy, have a very productive week. Because like I always say, the best thing about doing nothing is you can quit whenever you want. Have a great Sunday, people. Peace.